May it please the Court, Kevin Howard here for the appellant. Good morning, Your Honors. As I sat at my kitchen table last night poring over my two-page brief, I began to wonder what might be so interesting that all five justices would come together to hear this case. I'm certain you have questions. I really don't have a lot to add to the factual or legal arguments made in this, because I think that the issue is extremely limited, other than to highlight the fact that on virtually an identical record 2 weeks prior to trial, one Superior Court judge denies a motion for summary judgment because he says there is a material issue of fact for a jury and there is a duty. And then at the close of the evidence at trial, and I don't believe this is going to be disputed, but it may be, and if you examine the motion and the trial transcript, you can see that the record was virtually identical.
What do you mean by virtually identical? What was the difference?
I didn't see any difference, and that's why I think it's evident in the transcript. The motion for a directed verdict that was made by the defense was almost an afterthought, because the record was identical and a judge had already told us that we had a material issue of fact for the jury. And so, much to my surprise, a different judge decided to take it from the jury, even though in this case the driver of the vehicle candidly stated in court that the only thing more dangerous in his view than grabbing the steering wheel and yanking it was either shooting him while he was driving the car or exploding a bomb in the car. So with those things in mind, it was our view, and it still is, that he had a duty to do something. And certainly he was not the primary negligent actor in this scenario under any circumstances. But in our state, he only has to be 1% negligent in order to be included in the mix.
Well, is there a difference between characterizing this as a duty case and characterizing it as a proximate cause case? Even if he had a duty, what could he have done to prevent the passenger from grabbing the wheel a second time?
Immediately pull over and discharge the passenger. Or immediately pull over and require the passenger, if they wanted to continue in the car, to get in the back seat.
Was there testimony at the close of the plaintiff's case that both the other passenger and the driver stated that it was totally unexpected that the backseat passenger would grab the wheel a second time? No one could have anticipated that?
Well, Your Honor, that's an interesting question. There was testimony from the plaintiff in the case that at the first on the first occasion when the wheel was grabbed, the driver and the perpetrator laughed it off as if it was funny, horseplay. And in my view, the jury could have concluded that was basically an invitation to continue the conduct. That is in the record. Now, I wouldn't be standing here had the driver done something, anything, but if he was horsing around, which I believe the jury could have concluded, then I think his conduct is a proximate cause.
Well, what I'm trying to understand is how does one have a duty to prevent unexpected conduct?
Well, unexpected in this case, I'm not sure that's what the record indicates. The driver, after the first event, had to be aware that there was a dangerous element in his vehicle. And at that point, he had a duty to anticipate the potential that it might happen again, or something like that, that the passenger might take repeat the conduct.
So you suppose the weight against the potential problem of dumping a 16-year-old out on the side of the highway?
Well, I think that might be an extreme characterization of his options.
It's more fun to characterize it extremely. Hyperbole is more fun than straight fact.
On that stretch of road, at trial, he testified that there were a number of businesses that were open. So he had access to phone. He could have pulled in, could have phoned her parents. He was apparently familiar with her. She was the best friend of his girlfriend. So he had those options as well. So it wouldn't have been just dumping her on the side of the road. In fact, along that stretch of road, there's a police troop.
Well, then my final question is, articulate the duty that you believe the driver owed to the passenger in the right front seat and didn't discharge. What duty as a matter of law did the driver have?
To take some measure to prevent the repeat conduct. The extreme would be to discharge the passenger on the side of the road. Maybe the minimally invasive measure would be to require that passenger to get in the back seat. But to do something to emphasize that the conduct was unsafe and did not belong in the vehicle. But to laugh it off is excuse me, Your Honor.
Yeah, go ahead.
But to laugh it off as if it's a joke is an invitation for disaster, and that's what happened here.
Does foreseeability play any role in this at all?
I think it does, but I think after that conduct was engaged in and no measure was taken, it was foreseeable it would be repeated. In a global sense, now, these are all teenagers sitting in a car, and perhaps not as experienced as, say, an old guy like me, but still some measure of care on the part of the driver to ensure his own safety and the other passenger's safety is required.
I'd like to turn to the law of the case issue for a moment. Is it correct that at the trial there were two different trial judges?
No, Your Honor. It was only one trial judge, but the motion for summary judgment was heard on the motion day
It was a motion for summary judgment denied, followed by a trial.
Followed by the trial. Two weeks later, followed by the trial.
I see. All right.
And the only interesting part of that is that the motion for summary judgment had attached to it the transcript from the Rule 16 arbitration, which included the version of events from both the driver of the car and the plaintiff, and the testimony was unchanged at trial.
Under the law of the case doctrine, normally the second judge had to put on the record why the first judge was clearly wrong in not granting summary judgment. Was that done in this case?
No, Your Honor. It wasn't done, the trial judge was made aware of the fact, and the court's file indicated that the motion for summary judgment had been denied. And at argument, in connection with the motion for directed verdict, I highlighted all the things I'm highlighting for you right now in terms of the previous ruling.
But there was a live trial, you know, where at least two of the people that were in the car testified.
That's correct.
And the record before the judge who denied summary judgment was a paper record.
It was, but in the context of a directed verdict, that testimony had to be viewed in a light most favorable to the plaintiff.
Well, as I understood it, the summary judgment involved a legal question. Is this a theory that we're going to submit to the jury? And the ruling on summary judgment was, yes, this is a jury question. And then the directed verdict said, as a matter of law, this is not a legal question for the jury. Is that correct?
Your Honor, in my two-page argument, I actually cited the text of the motion judge's ruling, and bring my glasses today, but he identified both issues. To quote it,
well, he would. There would have to be an issue of law and a dispute of fact.
He said, I think it could create some issue of care, some issue of whether there was carelessness on the driver's part in not admonishing the passenger more vigorously, that you can't do that. Well, I think it's for a jury to decide whether he reacted adequately when the wheel was pulled the first time. So I think he decided that there was a duty, and he decided that there was a triable issue as to whether it was breached.
Well, but didn't the trial judge base his decision also on proximate cause? And is it fair to say that the judge on summary judgment even considered proximate cause? Isn't proximate cause a new issue that is first really confronted in the trial context?
My recollection of the argument on the motion for summary judgment, which I don't have a record of, was more global than that, and those issues were addressed. Granted, the motion judge did not issue a written opinion. This is just an excerpt from the transcript, and perhaps if he had, that this wouldn't be an issue. But
actually, what makes this case interesting is actually, as I hear what you just read, it sounds to me like the motion judge decided the case on an issue of proximate cause and never address the issue of whether a duty existed in the first place.
Well, I don't disagree, Your Honor.
And that's why I asked you the question, on these facts, what is the legal duty owed? And
I
wonder how you articulate that duty.
It's not as clear as the situation where somebody violates the motor vehicle code. We have a duty to abide by the motor vehicle code.
Well, they're common law duties. Keep your vehicle under control. Keep a proper lookout. That's so broadly worded, it's not limited to what's coming at you on the roadway. It could be attached to the conduct of passengers in the car that might create a situation.
Well, I don't think it's, in general, there's no duty to anticipate negligence. But once you're in a circumstance where you're aware that there's a danger, and you're the captain of the ship, in this case, the driver of a car.
You know how hard it is when you're defending one of these cases to get a judge to give a charge on no duty to anticipate negligence? It's almost impossible. At least that's the way I recall it.
And actually, that charge was given in this case, that there was no duty to anticipate negligence. But the charge went on to highlight the fact that if you were aware of a known danger, then you have a duty of care to take measures to protect your, I don't think the word passenger was used, but you have a heightened duty of care.
So, as I understand your earlier answer, there are at least three hierarchies of response. Once someone grabs your wheel, you, at a minimum, tell them it's unacceptable and they can't do it again, which wasn't done here, or you put them in the back seat, which wasn't done here, or you have them leave the vehicle, which wasn't done here.
I'm sure there are other possibilities, but you don't laugh it off to invite the conduct to continue. The plaintiff testified that that's what happened here, that the driver laughed it off like it was a joke, like kids horsing around. And I don't think it's a stretch to suggest that that invited a repeat of the conduct.
So what distinguishes this case from the other cases we've been talking about is the notice that the passenger had done this. If the vehicle had crashed the first time it happened, I think you've said in your brief you wouldn't have an argument. But your argument is predicated on the fact that it did happen and no remedial action was taken.
That's correct, and that's exactly what the motion judge said. If it only grabbed the wheel once, he would have granted summary judgment. And in my view, that's...
Well, I interpret that as the proximate cause of this accident was a failure to do something. But before that, is there a duty?
Not without some notice of a danger that's present.
So your view is that the duty exists after the wheel is grabbed the first time. That creates the duty.
That's correct.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court, Philip Edwards for Murphy and Landon, on behalf of the defendant Jonathan Parcell. The issue on appeal here is, as the Court touched on in the initial argument, is whether Mr. Parcell had a duty to his passenger, the plaintiff, Ms. Parcell, to anticipate not just negligence, but an intentional, reckless conduct by another passenger in his vehicle. That's the issue here. That's the issue that the trial court, at the close of the evidence, decided. He decided there was no duty.
Is it reasonable for a driver who just had their wheel grabbed and avoided an accident to laugh it off?
Well, the standard of care here is people of reasonable like, age, and experience. I can't answer that question in the context of how I would respond or how Your Honor would respond or how any adult would respond. This is three kids, 16 years old from high school, taking his girlfriend and her best friend home. Now,
do you think that's going to make any difference to a person who's killed or seriously injured? That they were killed or seriously injured by the conduct of a 16-year-old driver?
I don't think so, Your Honor, but I think the law makes a distinction in that respect. I'm married to that testimony because the testimony was materially different between my client and the plaintiff here. My client said that no one laughed. There was kind of nothing said afterwards, but the plaintiff did say my client laughed. So on this motion here, the standard of review here, we have to take the facts in a light most favorable to the plaintiff. So as I stand here today, the facts are that he chuckled it off, he laughed it off.
Let's change the facts a little bit. Let's assume that Ms. Beisel had grabbed the steering wheel 10 times and your client had been able to hang on those 10 times. Mm-hmm. No duty to do anything in anticipation of an 11th time. No, which what I'm trying to figure out is there no duty or is it a foreseeability question?
Well, I don't believe it's a foreseeability question because foreseeability deals with facts. Duty is an issue of law to be determined by the trial judge.
Because if it's foreseeable, it's got to be. If this is a question of foreseeability, the judgment below has got to be reversed. You agree with that, don't you?
If it's as to proximate cause or as to duty?
As to duty. But that's...
I respectfully don't believe so.
Okay. But explain to me why if Ms. Beisel had grabbed the steering wheel 10 times, your client was under no duty to do anything about it.
Well, there's also a temporal element here if he was able to do something about it when you get to foreseeability.
But that may be an explanation of why he didn't do anything. We're talking about a pure legal question of is there ever a duty when someone keeps grabbing your steering wheel? And you seem to be saying there's never a duty.
Because the duty that you impose onto the plaintiff or to my client in the situation has to be a duty under which they have some control. He has no control over what Ms. Beisel is her name, Joanie Beisel, was doing in that car that day. He has no control whether he says stop, whether he reprimands her three times. When is it enough? That becomes a factual issue for the jury to determine.
Mr. Howard suggests he can put her out of the car.
And I find that to be totally unreasonable. But if he pulls her out of the car, this happened 30 seconds later. If he pulls over the car within 40 seconds, it's already happened. He's got to slam on the brakes, pull the car over, get her out of the car within 30 seconds. That's the testimony on the record here. The second pull happened within 30 seconds. And first of all, and second of all, the trial judge agreed with me, it's entirely unreasonable to eject a 16-year-old girl out inside of Route 1 within 30 seconds. There's no testimony that they were passing the Grand Slam right as the second pull happened. There's no testimony as to there was the police barricade right there when the pull happened. They were in a wooded area of the road.
Let's look at a different hypothetical. Let's suppose we still have 16-year-olds in the car, just as in your case, and one of them spills a soft drink on the driver, and the driver temporarily loses control, swerves in reaction to mm-hmm. the soft drink, and lands. And then this soft drink is spilled on the driver again, same problem, except as in this case, there's an accident. As I understand your argument, you don't have any obligation and you can't prevent another 16-year-old passenger from continuing to pour their drink on you.
No, because you have no control over their person. That's any situation. The problem I have with plaintiff's position and is that a duty imposed on a person has to be something that's under their physical control.
Go ahead.
Tell me what circumstances, if any, you can envision when a 16-year-old has to do something to take control over the conduct of another 16-year-old passenger. Or is the law as you understand it, 16-year-olds can carry on any way they want to in the car if they're a passenger, and there's no duty for the driver to do anything?
Well, and to answer that question, we have to look at, as Justice Steele touched on in the initial argument, where do the duties come from of a driver, a 16-year-old or an adult? Common law and statutory, I made a list of them here. Where do we find the duty? Because the trial does have to know this isn't an issue of fact. It has to be decided before the case whether there's a duty. And the duty is listed. There's 21 Delaware Code 4168.
Well, let's just take one, the duty to keep your vehicle under proper control.
Yes.
All of this goes to the common law duty, does it not, that the driver is obligated to keep the vehicle under control. Does it become a jury question whether or not this driver did all he could do to keep his vehicle under control, i.e., prevent the passenger who grabbed the wheel the first time from grabbing it the second time?
Well, no, because that entails the duty, not only duty, it's now morphing into two simultaneous duties going on. The duty to keep a proper lookout. The duty to keep your car under control is to keep a proper lookout, obey the speed limit, obey street signs, do all those things. Now we're imposing a second level of duty onto him, also to keep an eye out for any third party that may intentionally and recklessly cause your vehicle to go out of control.
Let me ask you my question again, but more directly, because my question was, give me an example of something a 16-year-old driver has to do to control another 16-year-old passenger. So we'll just let that go because you apparently declined to answer it. So my current question is, hypothetically, you have people 16 years old in the car having a French fry fight. You know, they're just throwing French fries back and forth at each other, mm-hmm. and the driver is having difficulty controlling the car. Does the 16-year-old driver have any obligation to tell the other two 16-year-olds to stop engaging in the food fight so they can he can control the car?
Well, under that circumstance, maybe. And that's why it's tough, because those people who are having the French fry fight may not know that their conduct is reckless at the time. There's no essentially duty to warn someone of conduct they know is reckless and dangerous. Having the French fry fight, those two 16-year-old children can think, well, just because we're throwing French fries at each other doesn't mean we could cause the vehicle to go out of control. It's entirely distinguishable in this instance where Ms. Beasel absolutely knows that pulling the wheel will cause the vehicle to lose control, and just as it did. And
well, let me take it a little bit differently. If we all agree that the driver of any vehicle has a duty to exercise reasonable care to keep the vehicle under control, right?
Yes.
Okay. On a day like today, that may mean driving slower because it's raining and the roads are wet. Under other circumstances, there may be other specific facts that warrant behavior in response to those facts, all going to the duty to keep your vehicle under control, right? So if the problem is not from outside the car, but is from something inside the car, doesn't that same duty still exist? Forgetting specific facts, but doesn't the duty to keep your car under control apply equally to situations that may be inside the car that may impact your ability to keep it under control?
Well, Your Honor, when I looked at the statutory language that imposes the duty as to motor vehicles, those were two different things you touched on there. They're actually codified in two different sections. One says keep it under control, and also it depends on what the court means by control.
Well,
is control paying attention to the
–
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No, the question was really pretty simple. I don't care about specifically what the problem is inside of the car. But isn't there a duty for the driver to do the best he or she can to keep his car under control? Isn't that, and doesn't that duty apply to certain situations that may be inside the car as well as external situations like the weather?
No, Your Honor, because I believe, respectfully no, because I'm parsing it out even further than Your Honor's. Your Honor is saying there's external and internal forces here. There may be external and internal, but there's also, I'm separating internal as opposed to what a passenger may do, to what your actual responsibilities and obligations, your duties are in operating the vehicle. Proper speed, keeping the vehicle proper lookout, stopping at stop signs, things of that nature. That's what your primary obligation is when you're driving a vehicle. It's not to anticipate.
You're trying to apply the facts of this case. I don't care about the facts of this case. I want either a yes or a no. Does a driver of a car have a duty to keep his car under control in response to something that might happen inside his car that would jeopardize keeping it under control? Does he have a duty to try and keep it under control?
Yes, to the extent that he can control the acts.
Okay, fine.
If he cannot control the passenger's acts, he has no duty to control them.
But that becomes a factual question for the jury to resolve, whether given the duty to keep the vehicle under control, under the circumstances of this case, did he do all he could do in keeping the vehicle under control, or whether was there something he didn't do that was the proximate cause of the accident?
Well, Your Honor, that makes the duty standard so amorphous and so clouded that there's no real clear picture as to what the duty actually is.
Let me suggest this. If it's not safe to operate the car, shouldn't he pull the car off the side of the road?
Maybe.
That way he eliminates the risk.
Maybe.
Because we're not only talking about a risk to other passengers, we're talking about a risk to pedestrians and other people on the highway.
Yes, but that doesn't solve the problem, because what if she pulls the wheel as he's pulling over?
Well, the shorter the time he's driving in a risky situation, the better off he is, the better off society is.
So then what is his duty then, to sit on the side of the road and wait for 5 hours or wait for a tow truck to come get them to eject the girl? I think that's totally, I think that, the line of, that's exactly what plaintiff is arguing in a sense, that these all these unreasonable steps that they can think up may be the duty now.
But haven't you, you know, by calling these steps unreasonable, haven't you put the rabbit in the hat? In other words, doesn't a jury always have to decide whether, given the entire situation that we've been told about, did this driver act reasonably or not?
Well, that's if there's a duty established, and I don't believe there has been, because, again, our position is, and what I believe the law is that you have a duty, yes, to keep your car under control. There's no testimony here, there's no argument from the plaintiff that he was not driving the car, operating the vehicle in a safe manner. Now we're adding a duty. What plaintiff, I wrote it down when Justice Steele asked him what the duty was, to take some measure to prevent the conduct. Now we're adding a second duty, not just to keep the vehicle, the actual operation of the vehicle under control, but now to take some action. So this is now a separate duty being imposed.
Well,
that's a slippery slope when we get into what the duty may be.
Is it really under circumstances where the wheel was grabbed the first time? There is a known risk, and isn't it for the jury to assess the extent to which a reasonable person under these circumstances could believe that the passenger might grab the wheel a second time? Because the risk was clear when it was grabbed the first time. They almost ran off the road and it got involved in an accident the first time around.
Well, Your Honor, then the question begs to be asked, what is the duty then?
Well,
is the duty to warn?
From the 16-year-old. What if the person was 40 years old? What would your answer be with relationship to the duty?
That you still have no duty to warn someone not to engage in known dangerous conduct.
So then the fact that we've been talking about the 16-year-old really is not relevant to your argument in this case?
No, that goes more to reasonableness, foreseeability, and proximate cause. Right now, it's duty, and what I'm trying to focus on is duty here, because the case law that I highlight in my brief is there's no duty to warn people of known dangerous conduct. The Fritz case, I believe, is a case where this court held that there's no duty to warn someone as to the dangers that you can cut off your hand on a table saw. The Farm Family case, there's no duty to warn someone that there's that sliced up in a chicken feed case. There's no duty to warn someone that cut up newspaper is flammable. The Cudafaris case, which I didn't cite,
doesn't that fit this perfectly? There would have been no duty to anticipate grabbing the wheel the first time if that had caused an accident.
Well, the duty that plaintiff is seeking here is not a duty to anticipate necessarily. It's one step further. It's a duty to anticipate and then warn and take some action. So that would be a whole new duty that we'd be adding to this codified list in 21 Del Code, a new duty, and we'd actually be overturning the established Delaware precedent that there's no duty to warn someone not to engage in a known danger. So we'd actually be creating an exception. You have no duty to warn someone not to engage in a known danger, except if you're driving a motor vehicle. Then you have an obligation to warn them not to do that.
If your position does not prevail, what cases will we have to overrule?
Fritz, Cudafaris, Farm Family, Fritz versus Jaeger.
And your position is they are all duty to warn cases?
Absolutely.
They're not duty to keep a vehicle under control?
They are all duty to warn cases. That's the lie, because plaintiff is not just seeking a duty to anticipate. It's anticipate and something, and do something, to prevent something. And that creates a slippery slope. That creates a duty standard that's now not just to be decided by, it'll be decided by a duty to be decided by the trial judge based on the facts and circumstances of the case, which is not necessarily what we want. We want clear duty established what you have to do in a car. And when I was driving down here, and Your Honor said that hyperbole is usually more fun, I was thinking of analogies to trip throughout.
Can I take it back now?
And I'm thinking it's pumpkin chunking time down here, and it's a week before, and now there's a new accuracy competition, and two guys are out in the field, and they start launching pumpkins out there, and now they're going to put it in as to accuracy. And there's a road abutting the field. Now they start launching pumpkins out into the field as my client and his passenger driving down the road, and a pumpkin crashes right in the middle of the road. Now he's on notice. He can anticipate that someone is doing an obviously intentional, reckless act of launching pumpkins out into the road. Okay, now the duty is he should anticipate that they should do it again. But what's the following duty? The duty would be, does he have to roll down his window and yell, hey, you can kill us, don't do that again? Does that solve the problem? Is his duty then to speed up, to weave, to go 100 miles an hour to avoid the pumpkins? It just creates a never-ending stream of duties that the plaintiff could argue that they have to go through to establish that they acted reasonably. Now, what if he speeds up 100 miles an hour and he says, all right, as Justice Berger said, we'll pull over. He pulls over the car, and then the pumpkin lands smack through the windshield and kills the person. Was his duty to find cover from the pumpkins?
Is it correct that every personal injury complaint involving a motor vehicle continues to have in it, in addition to specific violations of Title 21, the two common law duties of failure to keep a proper lookout and failure to keep a vehicle under control?
Yes, they do, Your Honor, and that's actually the jury instruction as well. But the proper lookout has been codified.
Let me follow up. You mentioned the dangers of the slippery slope because of amorphous duties. What is more amorphous than keeping the duty to keep your vehicle under control without more specificity, or failure to keep a proper lookout without more specificity?
Maybe I haven't been clear, but my argument is not just that the duty is to keep a proper lookout, but it's also a duty. You don't have a duty to anticipate the intentional or reckless act of another under which you have no control. The plaintiff's asking for two duties. He's asking for a duty to keep your car under control and a duty to warn or a duty to take some kind of preventive measures to prevent the car from going off the road. I'm saying the duty is, yes, you have a duty to keep your car under control and keep a proper lookout and all those things that are codified in 21 Delaware Code, but there also, under Delaware precedent, there is no duty to warn someone not to engage in known dangerous activity. I'm in my house, just as if it's my car, and there's a puddle there or ice there, and my guest is standing there, and we look and I say, gosh, I haven't been able to get rid of that ice. So now he's on notice that I have ice there, and that he knows that ice is slippery, and then he walks on it and slips on it and cracks his back. The case law says you have no duty to warn that someone of something that they know is dangerous. I mean, we have to look at exactly what the effect of a warning is. What does a warning do? And that's what plaintiff is asking you to impose on my client, a duty to warn. The effect of a warning is to put someone on notice that some conduct may injure someone or yourself.
Well, I must be missing something. I don't understand where the duty to warn has anything to do with this case. I thought the idea is that the driver of the car had a duty to keep that car under control and do whatever he had to do to keep the car under control under the circumstances.
And part and parcel of that, Your Honor, is what plaintiff argued at trial when he argued here today, is that he has a duty to warn her not to do that.
Well,
he has a duty to take some measures.
Isn't all he's saying by that's one of the things that the driver could have done in the process of keeping the car under control by preventing in any way he could, reasonably, the passenger from grabbing the wheel the second time? But that doesn't touch on the original duty to keep the vehicle under control.
No, it's adding an additional duty.
No, it's just adding a factual circumstance, isn't it, that would have assisted, arguably, in an argument to the jury, the driver in keeping the vehicle under control, and an example of one thing he did not do that might have helped. It's not a duty issue at all.
Well, I guess, Your Honor, I interpret or I see the duty as to keep your car under control, not including anticipating the intentional reckless acts of another and then somehow preventing them. And in the court's question there, the court is lumping all the duties that I'm parsing out as separate and distinct duties that we're trying to add now into one, the whole encompassing to keep your car under control and keep your car under proper control. So I guess then it becomes a factual issue and a decision for the court as to whether how broad do we define the duty to keep your car under control? Does it encompass a duty to warn someone not to engage in conduct you're now aware of? Does it include not only a duty to warn that person not to engage in that conduct, but a duty to somehow take measures to prevent them from doing it? A conduct you may not know happened, but you can anticipate it may happen because it's happened before. So I guess our position is, and how I understand the law to be, and how our position here is, that the duty to warn and the duty to take these preventive measures and the duty to do all these other things are not all wrapped up and are not encompassed in the duty codified as to keep your car under proper control. Because you can't control that person. You can't control that external force that is now making the car go off. Because it can only be things that are under your control. You can say, you can talk to your blue in the face, and which I think you don't have a duty to do, as I've said many times, because you don't have a duty to warn someone not to do something they know is dangerous.
Would you take that position if it was a parent driving the car with a 16-year-old child of the parent sitting next to them, and the 16-year-old kept grabbing the steering wheel?
Yes, Your Honor, because I don't see the duty to warn as encompassed in the duty to keep your car under control. I see the duty to warn as a separate and distinct duty. The plaintiff is asking the court to add on to the duty to keep your car under control. There's no duty under as I said, Fritz, under Farm Family, under all those issues, to tell anyone, to warn anyone, or to take steps to prevent anyone from engaging in conduct they know is dangerous. And that's the duty, and that's the added duty that the court, in their questioning, has insinuated that may be wrapped up in that duty to keep your car under control.
Well, I don't like to disagree with counsel when they're making an oral argument, but when counsel attempts to characterize what the court is doing,
I'm sorry,
I have to disagree with you. I don't think you can make the point at all that the questions that have been directed to you suggest that there's a duty to warn issue here. In fact, no one could have articulated the opposite any better than Justice Berger and her last question. What we're talking about is whether, as a matter of law, the trial judge erred when the trial judge took from the jury the issue of liability in this case by concluding that the driver owed no duty to the passenger. The issue is, was there a duty? What is the scope of that duty? How one would articulate it? And then what are the facts that suggest a jury would resolve proximate cause and make judgments about whether that duty was fulfilled or not? Satisfy me that the trial judge here didn't decide what he did, or she did, whoever it may have been, because the judge did not anticipate that no jury would ever reach a liability verdict in favor of the plaintiff here, given the facts.
Well, the judge made his decision on two points. One, that he established there was no duty to take preventive measures to stop her from pulling the wheel. That was the judge's first decision. He said, I do not think encompassed in these rules and these duties outlined and codified in 21 Delaware Code, even with the keep your car under proper control, there was no duty for my client, Jonathan Parcell, to do anything that plaintiff was arguing, essentially admonish the person, kick them out of the vehicle, do anything of that nature. His sole duty was under his body to keep the car under control and to do the best he could in that, and his duty was not to prevent someone else from interfering with his operation of the vehicle at that time. That's the first decision as what he decided. Second, he decided that if, assuming for argument's sake here, there was a duty, that his failure to warn her, his failure to tell her not to do something, his failure to pull over the vehicle, failure to admonish her, was not the proximate cause of the accident, because if he told her, don't do that again, she could still pull the wheel. If he said, get out of the front seat, it was a front bench seat, if he told her, get in the back seat, she could still reach over and pull the wheel over. If he pulled over the vehicle and sat there for 15 minutes and they picked up down the road again, she could still pull the wheel. I believe his decision was it's but for his failure to do anything was not the cause of the accident. But for but for Ms. Beasel's actions, this accident happened, not anything that my client did.
You're not arguing that Ms. Beasel's actions were a supervening cause, are you?
No, my argument, and I never mentioned superseding or intervening cause purposely, because my sole argument is that Mr. Parcell was not negligent because he did not have a duty to do anything after the first wheel was pulled, and also that even if he did have a duty, his failure to warn her or take preventive actions in no way but for put that car off the road. Only the pole put the car off the road. Nothing he did. Thank you, Your Honors.
Yes.
I've only reserved a very short period of time to rebut learned counsel's argument, but I want to make sure the court is clear. I've never suggested a warning was something that had to be done. I spoke of admonishing the passenger not to engage in the conduct as one alternative under the circumstances. It wasn't, don't do that again because it's dangerous. Obviously, it was dangerous. It was more akin to example of a father with children in the car, you know, sit in your seat, buckle your seat belt. And in terms of analogies, I was trying to think of a couple that may somehow mirror this case, and the two that I came up with is you're driving along and you have your children in the back seat and one of them lights a fire, and it's only a small fire, but it's a fire nonetheless. So what is your duty under those circumstances? You obviously have a dangerous condition now in your car, and it may affect your ability to control the vehicle. Do you just keep driving down the road because you can't control the fire? Another one is you're riding with your kids and they have a snake in a cage and they let the snake out in the car and they say, "Hey, Dad, we've just let the snake out in the car." Do you just keep driving down the road at that point, or do you pull over and make sure the snake doesn't bite you or bite the passenger or create a circumstance where you crash the car? Those are the two analogies I think of. If there are no other questions, I have no additional argument.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and assess.